Morning, what is the number?
And the staff member from our guest, from the state law advisor, and our old friends, I think PMG, and Salga. Yeah, Salga. Okay. You are welcome this morning. We are continuing with the deliberations on the amendment bill, Corandala Housing Amendment Bill. We will recall that we are having so many difficulties in because of lot of in fact we need more information on this bill. Otherwise we don't want to do umsebenzi ongaphucukanga. When we finalize this bill, we want to have a bill which is going to be helpful and which is going to be user-friendly, because seemingly even the Principal Act, Mr. Steen, when I was looking at it, it's not user-friendly, that Principal Act. And when you look at the Principal Act and then you look at the amendments, there's no consistency in terms of the headings. So you will find that they will refer to the rights and obligations of tenants as well as the landlords in the amendment bill, and then when you come to the Principal Act, you will find something else that is different from what they are saying. So there's quite a lot of inconsistency, and I think as the Portfolio Committee, we need to apply our mind in ensuring that we clean up this this bill. I think at the end of the day, I think we might end up recommending the draft for they're recommending the bill for redraft, seemingly, but I'm not preempting, but as I was reading the bill and then the Principal Act, and there's quite a lot of misprints. That is why we follow up the bill until iphume at the Parliament. There's quite a lot of misprints, and then when the people on the ground, they are reading through this bill, definitely you get confused with what is it all about, because even the content, it just changes. So we still have a lot to do as this Portfolio Committee. But I wish to apologize to the state law advisors, because we thought that the department will inform them, but seemingly the department and that's going to be kumbile na. Ubangalale kumbile, inaski kumbe matot. Because ke, we are doing our job. I don't see a reason why they did not advise the state law advisors that today we are going to be deliberating on this bill. In fact, we're going to look at the Principal Act as the Portfolio Committee. So they should have communicated that to them. But yeah, I am taking that responsibility on behalf of the Portfolio Committee to apologize but hoping that at least we will communicate, Colisa is going to communicate with the state law advisors too, and we'll finish the information of the issues that have been raised, and then so that next week we'll meet on Wednesday. So we sincerely apologize about that one. I thank you. Members, let us look. I've got a lot of documents in front of me. I don't know. Well, what is the proposal? Do we start by? Can you go straight to the principal act, or we give Charmaine the opportunity to raise some issues? The work that she has done overnight. What is the proposal?
Chair, yes, we could start with the work that Charmaine has done, but I wonder if I could just want to support what you have just said there about the work that we've got to do here. I have also been going through documents, and now the lights are really beginning to flash with this. And I want to just perhaps read from a document that came from Rights Empowerment, and it runs throughout, you know, documents. And they say here, whilst appreciating the amendments that we have here, they say that further amendments to the Act need to be considered as well in order to ensure that the Act and and in turn the Tribunal are effectively, fully and justly enforced. Now, another document here on social housing speaks about this being unenforceable as well. So, and I've got the reference there. It says the current Act in sections contradicts or clashes with the constitution of our land and or with other acts as well. So I think we have a really big job on our hands. Perhaps what we could do is to start with what Charmaine has got, because it's going to lead us into a lot of other stuff as well. And then maybe we can actually start from the beginning of that act. And the principal act and go through it.
Good morning, honourable members. I think if I could maybe just come back to you on or report back on the issue of Rule 249, where we have indicated yesterday. If there are amendments to the Principal Act that is not currently covered in the amendment bill, whether the committee may or must approach the National Assembly for permission. I have approached the National Assembly table for advice in this regard. And their interpretation is that Rule 249, simply the may there, simply indicates that the committee is allowed to request permission. In other words, it is not, what it is trying to say is, it is not that the committee must make additional amendments, it is simply that the committee may make additional amendments. And the process then is, according to the Assembly table, the same as if this committee is introducing new legislation. Their reasoning is that all legislation, all amendments follow a certain process. There's either a policy or a memorandum prepared by either your department or the committee or a private member. There is a certain approval process. Then only does the bill get drafted, and then there's a legislative process. And they say it's no different if the committee wants to add on to an amendment bill that is before you. In other words, if we are going to amend other sections in the Principal Act, the Assembly table views that as the introduction of legislation. Now, for that, the process is set out in Assembly Rule 238, which is actually not a very difficult process. It is a memorandum that has to be prepared that sets out the particulars, what the objects would be of these changes, whether there will be financial implications. And that's it. It's placed on the order paper, and then there is the necessary permission given. So I think after today's exercise, that memorandum is actually something that we can start drafting and present to the committee, maybe hopefully a draft by next week, to see what your thoughts are. Then the other work that I've done, I've also had a short discussion quickly with the department yesterday, especially on the review issue. And I've made a proposal to them that they seemed to be okay with. So what I did is I went back to my office, I looked at what was discussed, and I did a quick draft of all the amendments that the committee proposed. Now, I have sent this to the State Law Advisor, I've sent this to the department as well, because this is just wording proposed, etc., to be discussed still by the committee. So definitely work in progress. This is not the correct format even, so I apologize for that. But it was a bit of a quick process just to get these things on the table. If I can take you through the proposed amendments as requested by the I call it PC on HS, so that is the document that I'm working with. The establishment of tribunals to be within a budget period. There was a little bit of thinking, how will we word this? And the proposal that I have is that it must be within the first financial year following the commencement of the Rental Housing Amendment Act 2012. In other words, if the Act commences in May, that will have a longer period. If the Act commences in March, it will start in April this year. So that gives a definite budget period. So that is the proposal that I have there. On membership of the tribunal, that was actually something more with the department that has already been hashed out. I just noticed that there is still a mistake in this draft. Section 5, 1B, the words "not less than two" and "not more than" must also be deleted, because the agreement was now there must be six members. So that was just simply done there. I will just correct that as well in my correspondence with the department. Then on the next page, not replacing all the tribunal members at once, that is simply the proposal that I've actually made yesterday. I sent that to the department at their request as well. Then we spoke about the tribunal being able to sit in two places at once. So what I'm proposing is that we say provide in section 6.1, that we... I see there's a spelling mistake. I apologize for that. You can see it was a little bit of a rush job. I apologize for that. Not the tribunal, the tribunal. Now, people might think we're talking marriage and we're talking rental. Actually, it's not a marriage contract yet. Provided that the tribunal may, subject to sections 10.2b and 10.5. Now, what do those two sections say? 10.2b speaks about a deputy chairperson. Because remember, wherever the tribunal sits, there must be a chairperson. And your chairperson will probably only sit in one of the two. So 10.2b speaks about that there must be then a deputy chairperson, or if there's not a deputy chairperson, the members must elect a chairperson. So just to say that there must be a chairperson, and 10.5, which speaks to the quorum of three. So there's seven members in the tribunal, and provided that there's a chairperson and three members, they can then arrange two simultaneous meetings in different geographical areas for purposes of effective functioning. Now, I think the wording can still be played around with, but the idea was to say you can split two areas, and the reason for that is effective functioning. So if anyone...
looking at so many things here. Can I just be guided? I'm trying to find this 10.2b and 10.5, because I think there have been amendments also to 2007 that we don't have. So I just want to be sure that we're all on the same page here.
Yeah,
Theme 2B is in your Amendment Bill of 2007. I think that was handed out this morning.
Oh. Okay,
10 to B. I will see if I can also locate an act that has 2007s in. So 10 to B is in
what,
the... Yes. So that is where 2B is. And then 10-5 is currently being amended. So that you will find the new proposed version. You'll find in the 2011 bill. I'm currently not having a 2007 bill because you've got my, it was copied made from that. We'll find one. Here is one. Yeah. Okay, but it has to be in this one. It is page 4. Have you found it? Okay. So it simply reads, where the chairperson is not present at a meeting, the deputy chairperson presides, or if the deputy chairperson is not present, the members of the tribunal present must appoint from amongst themselves a member to preside at such a meeting. So that is simply that there must be a chairperson. And then 5 is in the current amendment. It reads, in the 2011 bill, clause 6, and I'm now talking about the bill that's introduced. I'm not talking about the one the department brought yesterday. Okay, so the bill is introduced, page 3, clause 6. It reads, by the substitution for subsection 5 of the following subsection, the quorum of any meeting of the tribunal is 3 members, of at which at least 2 must be members appointed in terms of section 9.1b. Now, the members also asked for an amendment there, so we will get to that in a moment. Okay. It's amendments on amendments on amendments. That is, in fact, the next one on the document proposed amendment, point 5, at least 1 member per meeting to have legal qualifications. So the subsection 5 then reads, the quorum of any meeting of the tribunal is 3 members, of which at least 2 must be members appointed in terms of section 3, which is the legal qualification, and section 9.1b1 or 2. In other words, 1 must be legal, 1 must be one of the other 2 categories. So that is the proposal there. Then on page, on the third page, point number 6, they have simply added the word or vary in the second row of 12a. So 12A now reads, the tribunal may, acting on its own accord or on application by any affected person, rescind or vary any of its rulings, if such rulings, and then it continues. Now, another aspect that the committee mentioned, you didn't go in full into it, but it was mentioned, so I thought, let me incorporate something and let's see how it looks, was one of the public comments was the concern about acting on its own accord and what that will do to the legality of a ruling. So I found a court case where the court actually said, but it is ridiculous that a court can't amend technical errors in its judgment. And I believe that is what the intent here is that the tribunal must, out of its own accord, correct errors. So what I've done is I've actually used the exact wording that was used in the court case. So the tribunal may act on its own accord when it is supplementing accessory or consequential matters. And then I made it including, because you can never, the court in fact said it's not an exhaustive list. You can't preempt every possibility that might be faced as far as errors go. But that might include a cost order, interest on ruling debts. Clarification of the ruling so as to give effect to the tribunal's true intention. Correcting clerical, arithmetical, or other errors in its ruling. Altering an order for costs where it was made without hearing the parties. So that is the kind of proposal there. And
can you explain this? What costs are you referring?
Thank you, Chief. Actually, as I was reading, I was wondering if the tribunal does in fact make cost orders. Yes, I would maybe just have to go and make sure whether there is in fact something like that. But I'll keep this in mind because I also know that there is going to be a discussion on extending the powers of the tribunal and the orders that they can make, whether they can make penalties, etc. So for now, I think I'll maybe take away the cost order, but then as we proceed and the committee might extend, then we might look at that again. Then lastly, a request was made in respect of a time limit within which this must be done. So my thinking was that if the tribunal is correcting a mistake, I don't think that there should be a time limit on that because a mistake is a mistake. Whenever you've discovered it, it must be corrected. But if it is for rescission or variation and it's an application from one of the parties, I think there must be a limit there. And the proposal is within 14 days of the ruling being made. We can make it 21 days, 28 days. 14 is usually a reasonable time for someone to have considered and to come back. Remember, this doesn't mean that the application must be heard. It simply means that you must make your application, you must bring it to the tribunal. So that is the proposal there. Then there was a big concern about review and the cost of review. And the department explained that, yes, it's quasi-judicial and it can only be brought on review, and they are right in the sense that you can't appeal from the tribunal to the court, because there's not a logical process, there's not a logical line of reporting almost, if I can call it that. But that does not stop an internal appeal. And that is what I then explained to the department. Can't we do this internally, especially now that we are saying the tribunal can be split? So what I'm proposing, and this will be one of the amendments to the Principal Act that is not currently included in the amendment bill, is that we say we amend the review, and we'll probably have to change the heading as well to review and appeal, or appeal and review, something like that, to say that without prejudice to the constitutional right of any person to gain access to a court of law, one, an application to appeal the ruling of the tribunal may be submitted to the tribunal within 21 days after the ruling was made. And here I have a little bit longer time because an appeal is actually a reconsideration of everything. It's not a simple, oh, please rescind, and then we can do the whole thing over. There's a lot more thought that has to go into an appeal. 21 days after the ruling was made, provided that the members of the tribunal who made the ruling may not hear the appeal. In other words, if this was the one sitting that heard it, it must go to the other sitting. And then I thought, but what if you had a sitting where the members were all together? What do you do then? And what I'm proposing there is to say, and where necessary, the chairperson must appoint alternate members in terms of Section 9.3 to hear the appeal. And then, of course, the remainder of the review stays. Now, on 9.3, I think there will have to be a further amendment, consequential, because it currently provides for two alternates, which is not sufficient. And in actual fact, looking at effective working of the tribunal, I would almost say that two alternates in general is not sufficient. If you have a quorum of three and people are sitting in one location and some of those members have the flu, the tribunal can't sit because you only have two alternates and they might be in another area at that point in time. So this might be a good amendment overall in any event. But to then change it to say the MEC may appoint persons to serve as alternate members of the tribunal in the absence of any member referred to in paragraph B, 1, 2, and 3. In other words, not in respect of the chairperson, in respect of the members themselves, but such persons must have the relevant expertise contemplated in paragraph B, 1, 2, and 3 of subsection 1, respectively. In other words, alternates, there may be six alternates appointed, but they must still have the same qualifications as the ones that do not. So those are the amendments that were discussed yesterday. I did not look at the public comment requests for amendments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sami. That's quite a very, very good assignment that you have done. At least it gives us some light. It's time for interaction. Honorable Njobe, Honorable Bonen, and then Honorable Singh.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I'm looking at Clause 7, Section 13, 12, C. firstly, I must say I am quite happy with the amendments that have been made there on 12A in particular. But looking at 12C, the time frame, the 14 days that the application for rescission of variation must be brought within 14 days of the ruling being made. Who are we referring to here? I'm trying to find out if 14 days is not too short. Is this the person who will have been informed about the decision? They know the decision. And now, if they would like that decision to be varied, to be changed, they must bring it, they must bring the application within 14 days. Is it taken for granted that the person affected will have been informed immediately when the decision is made? Is it not possible that there can be a period of communicating the decision between the time the decision is made by the tribunal and the time this person receives this decision? Knowing how difficult communication can be in some areas in our country, it can take even more than 14 days for such a decision to be communicated. But now, if we are saying 14 days from the time the decision has been made, I would just like to be clarified on that. Maybe I'm not looking at it correctly.
Yes, Chair, I think I'll come in. I've got some new thing to ask Charmaine, but what I would like to say is when we, and I like what she's done, and she's actually gone ahead of some of the things in that, you know, when you start picking and changing the consequences, the consequential amendments then that don't result from that, and you've picked up on that, so that's very good. But I think, Chair, I will just pass on this one. I want to ask you something else new.
Yeah, just on a point of clarity, really. I'm also grateful for this, and I've got some questions and or additions, but just in terms of the way forward, are we going to just discuss these proposed amendments and sort of fine-tune them, or are we going to come back to them when we get to the relevant section where we then debate it, change it, amend it, and get the final version that we want in the book? So just do I put questions now, or do I do it later when we get to the clauses by clause? All right, really, it's really just two that I've got now, Chairperson, and the one relates to the appeals. It also relates to 12C, where and it touches on the time period. I'm not going to discuss the merits of the 14 days at this point, but I think we should make an allowance. What we're saying here is an application for rescission. Now, earlier on, we said that the tribunal may, of its own accord, or on application. Then we prescribe a time for application, but I think the same time should apply should the tribunal, of its own accord, wish to rescind a ruling. Because we're not giving them that sort of time limit, which means they may 6 months later decide to rescind it, and it then does away with that question mark we had in terms of once the ruling has been given, is it going to be legitimate for any period of time. So I think an amendment there, so it applies both to the tribunal if they want to do it of their own accord, as well as to an application. Then in terms of 17, and I fully agree with this, we brought it up. However, I think we should embellish that a little bit, because there should be, one doesn't want people who have been found guilty of something and been granted an order against them to try and make frivolous use of appeal processes to delay the process of justice. And therefore, there are usually certain conditions under which one can appeal things. And whilst we do not want to go into detail here, we should perhaps add something in the prescribed manner, can then be prescribed under regulation, under what conditions or what must be fulfilled in order to apply for an appeal. Thank you.
Okay, I think you can respond to a couple of questions and then we'll proceed to the Principal Act. And then, I don't know, because we'll look at the Principal Act and also look at the proposals. But I've got a lot of papers in front of us, but let's try what we are collected. And okay, you can continue.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think mainly the question is around the 14 days. What we perhaps can do, the 14 days is up for discussion. That was simply a suggestion. But what might be a good change is instead of saying within 14 days of the ruling being made, to change that to say within 14 days of receipt of the ruling by the person applying, something like that. Because that means that if it takes 3 months for you to be in receipt of the ruling, it might be a big housing corporation that doesn't really, you know, they want people out, et cetera, but they're not really diligent in following up and sending these things out. And if that happens, then at least the person, even though it's 3 months later, still has 14 days, or whatever the committee decides, 21 days, a calendar month, 2 calendar months, whatever the point is. In respect of the tribunal, like I said, the only reason why I didn't put a reason for them was because I limited the aspects on which they may make changes. But there is not a problem. I can include somehow the application. I'll maybe just change that wording somewhere to indicate that it must be done also within a certain period. And then in respect of the appeal, I think I can definitely add the prescribed condition.
Chairperson, may I just use the opportunity to raise something that is really of concern to me that was discussed yesterday, and just to see perhaps Charmaine was present and what she feels about it. And I don't want to be like a bulldog who gets hold of something and then doesn't let it go, but it's really troubling me. And that is related to the financial implications of the bill. I want to just say that in the Gauteng, and I come from local government, and I know what these unfunded mandates are doing to local government. In this document that the Gauteng Tribunal left with us, it says here that the difficulty of establishing information officers as an unfunded mandate, that's the heading, and then it says,
The major difficulty concerning the establishment of information officers is their unfunded mandate. Another difficulty is the local authorities' failure to commit themselves to ensuring that information officers fulfill their functions under Section 14.3 of the Act. Now, if you go to Section 14.3 of the Act, there are quite onerous, I think, things there in the Principal Act. I don't have a page, but it's under Section 10, and it's headed Meetings of the Tribunal. And then it says that in Section 4, it refers to 14.3, a local authority may, at the request and at no cost to the tribunal, make a venue available for the meetings of the tribunal. And then 4, meetings of the tribunal must be convened for the consideration of any complaint referred to the tribunal in terms of Section 13. And if you look at Section 13, there's a huge list of complaints that can be taken to the tribunal. And B, any other matter which the tribunal may or must consider in terms of this Act. And then the quorum of the meeting. So what I'm saying is that the functions of this office are huge. And I'm concerned that we're brushing off the costs that are involved, and, you know, that we can't. And I'd like some comment from Charmaine about that. You know, do we pursue this, or is it okay for us to accept the explanation that really there's money that will be a budget for province, and then province will sort of, you know, do we not have to get something a little clearer than that? And my concern is that so often we do this legislation and then we can't implement it because of the costs. And municipalities are really stretched. They can't be expected to add things, you know, onto that. So, I just would like some comments about that.
May I? I'm looking at this honourable comment that you are referring to.
Yes.
These issues are referred to the tribunal itself, but I would suggest that let's get straight to the functions of the information, the role of the information officers. So, yeah, I'm sure you were very confused. This thing, it's not user-friendly. When you read this, you will find that this legislation is amazing, even itself, the main... The Principal Act, it's giving us a lot of problems. So, as I was saying, one of the problems, you were referring to something else.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was supposed to be referring to 14.3.
Yes.
And that gives you a list here. You know, it's to educate, it's to provide advice, and this is where you get things like, I don't know what panics are, and I don't know what parries are, but these are all the mistakes that are made in this section over here. It's a lot of things that this office has got to do. And then what about the financing, you know, of being able to do that? Sorry.
Can I respond to that in part? Whilst I had equal concerns about the funding, this particular one, after the explanation yesterday about the National Department giving the education to information officers and things like that, I'm not too concerned about it personally, because provinces, for one, and most of the metros, do and must have housing information officers. I'm talking about generally. People go there and they want to apply for a subsidized house. These are just some additional responsibilities that any information officer there that attends to other housing matters need to be made aware of. And I was certainly welcome the response from the department that they do provide a budget for educating such officers. And it doesn't have to be somebody that is appointed exclusively for rental problems. They can designate other. So an official or officials within such an information office that deal with general housing issues must just be trained to attend to rental issues as well. So for me personally, it's not too much of a concern. There shouldn't be too much additional financial responsibilities. If I'm there and I'm going to assist you with filling in a form to make an application, and I've been educated on advising you about rental problems, then it's just something else that I've been given some additional education. So just for me personally, I don't see that particular one as too much of a problem. Thanks, Chair.
So I think the issue of the finance on this matter is covered. Please, okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe something else that could just put minds at ease a bit. I have also followed up within my unit to make sure that I'm not talking nonsense, but I wasn't aware of any problem in this figure from Treasury that limits the Assembly's right to pass the legislation if it affects finance on another sphere, because that issue actually came up yesterday. So I've also gotten a little bit of more information, discussed it back in the unit. And the unit in the Constitutional Legal Services Office generally agrees that this is the Section 76 bill. So there is still a process in the provinces, a thorough process in the provinces after this process in this committee. And then your provinces will be more than able to say, but this is something that our budget does not allow for, and we cannot be expected, this cannot be, etc. And then they will make a proposal to amend, which will then come back, and there will be a consideration. And if the Assembly and the NCOP can't agree, there will be mediation. And so there is definite opportunity for the provinces to voice concern over these financial burdens that are placed on them, because definitely there are financial burdens placed on them in this act, in this bill.
Yes, I agree with the legal unit, but I think we must make an effort just to strengthen. I don't like a bill that comes back. I don't like it. We have to do a perfect job. So I think we need to secure that in the area where it is raised by the department, that we have to look if it is if it does not need to be strengthened, that the part that was raised by the department to say the provinces have to budget for this, yes, they have to. And we've given them an allowance to say this should begin, the implementation of this bill should begin, should follow the budget process. And then thirdly, the provinces must provide even if financial support to the local municipalities, more especially not the metros. The metros should budget for themselves, and then I think we need to strengthen, to tighten up there, so that when it comes to the provinces they must, because we are the policy legislators at the end of the day, so at least we must demonstrate a commitment. We are committed in ensuring that whatever legislation we pass is going to be of assistance to the masses of this country. Principal Act 2007 amendment, the current amendment, and we've got a lot of input from ourselves. So let us be steady. I was, when I was reading the Principal Act, I wanted to suggest that let's read the Act itself, the objective of the Act, and then as well as the preamble, and then let's start from the beginning. There are issues that have been identified there. Lilia, can you read for us? Principal Act.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. The purpose of the Act to define the responsibility of government in respect of rental housing property, to create mechanisms to promote the provision of rental housing property, to promote access to adequate housing through creating mechanisms to ensure the proper functioning of the rental housing market, to make provision for the establishment of rental housing tribunals, to define the functions, powers, and duties of such tribunals, to lay down general principles governing conflict resolution in the rental housing sector, to provide for the facilitation of sound relations between tenants and landlords, and for this purpose to lay down general requirements relating to leases, to repeal the Rental Control Act 1976, and to provide for matters connected therewith. Preamble. Whereas in terms of Section 26 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa of 1996, everyone has the right to have access to adequate housing. And whereas the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve the progressive realization of this right. And whereas no one may be evicted from their home or have their home demolished without an order of court made after considering all the relevant circumstances. And whereas no legislation may permit arbitrary evictions. And whereas rental housing is a key component of the housing sector. And whereas this is a need to promote the provision of rental housing. And whereas there is a need to balance the rights of tenants and landlords and to create mechanisms to protect both tenants and landlords against unfair practices and exploitation. And whereas there is a need to introduce mechanisms through which conflicts between tenants and landlords can be resolved speedily at minimum cost to the parties. Be it therefore enacted.
My concern here is in the preamble. There is a member of the public that has raised the issue of a definition of arbitrary eviction. And the department has not responded to, and it is there in the Act. And if it is not defined, I think it's a problem. Samina, I think you read that one. So can we talk about that? And then at the last clause saying landlord can be resolved speedily at minimum costs to the parties. Minimum costs. And as the portfolio committee will remember that, we are trying by all means to that at least most of the complaints can be resolved at no cost. And then we get to a minimum cost. So against the tribunal because we don't understand what costs are there in the tribunal. Because when was Charmaine presenting this thing, and she got it from these copies of the legislation, there's this cost. We should understand what are these costs for. Because in the latest legislations that we have passed, at least the issue of the cost is at the court. So we need to clarify, to be clarified on this one. That was my concern. And then looking at the amendments bill, is to the one, the proposed one, is to amend the Rental Housing Act of 1999 so as to substitute certain definitions to extend the application of Chapter 4 to all provinces, to require MECs to establish rental housing tribunals, to extend the powers of the rental housing tribunals to rescind any of its rulings, and to provide for matters connected herewith. So here, this amendment allows for certain definitions to be looked at, and they've decided to ignore that one. So I'm appealing to the portfolio committee to look at this, and then we agree on this. How can we include this definition? And secondly, the issue of rescinding. We have agreed that we are going to insert rescind or vary. So I don't know whether it is necessary to also put it here. So it's for discussion by the members. I thank you.
Yes, I do agree with you that we include. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm compared with what you have said, because I was looking on this of minimum cost. Actually, I was trying to fisher myself here and find out if they're talking about minimum cost. How much are they talking about? They talk about million. They're talking about 200 million because this one is a very challenging debate. So now I don't know, Chair, isn't that one of arbitrary evasions? What kind of evasion is that one? Yes.
I've just been going through both the 99 version of the bill, the original one, and the amended one. I don't find anywhere in there any mention made to any specific cost. However, I would imagine those are generally, if there are costs involved, for example, to submit a grievance or something, if, then I would imagine it would be in the regulations. Now, we're at a disadvantage because we don't have that as well. So we actually can't determine whether there are any costs involved. Generally, going through the bill, there aren't any costs to the people. So it clearly makes provision for an efficient and at minimum cost, whatever that may be. But I can't say what that minimum cost is unless if there is something in the regulations. Because I know with other pieces of legislation, they generally make people pay an amount to try and get people not to put any frivolous complaints in. But in this case, and without the department yet to tell us, I actually don't know, because we need to look at that then, but probably under the regulations.
Thanks, Chair. I think also we need to define the rights of both the tenants and the landlord. It must be clearly specified.
so that we can provide for the facilitation of sound relations between the two. Thanks, Chair.
I think Unisustain is right. We need to check this, because the way it is put here, it gives another impression. So it has to be cleared. But, Sami, can you come?
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe just what I've done with listening is I've added that we need to look at a definition for arbitrary eviction. We need to find out from the department the costs involved with the tribunal. Is there a cost order being made by them? What about prevention of frivolous litigation? Should they be allowed to make a cost order if they're not currently making it? But I think we need first feedback from the department on how it works at the moment, and then the committee will have to decide if they're not making cost orders at the moment, do we want them to make cost orders, but how do we prevent someone from overstepping? And then I've also now made a note that maybe to look at a separate section for the rights of tenants and the rights of landlords. So I will add that.
Hi, Susan, my own. Hello. We are back. Then we come to the page, chapter 2, we don't have to worry about. I mean, chapter 1 is definitions, so we have agreed that we will include this. But there was a proposal on the definitions that we include a corporate housing. But I checked, because I'm one of the people who were not convinced in including that, because I believe that corporate housing has got to do with ownership. But I consulted with Mr. Mazila, where do they feature in the cooperatives here. And then he told me that what they did, because they are participating in NEDLAC, and then they raised this issue, and when they looked at the final document that has been submitted to Parliament, tabled to Parliament, there's no mention of that. And he consulted with Advocate Gladi, and Advocate Gladi said no, they were not. He was not aware. They are going to make sure that it is put in. Then it is not there. I told him that it is not there, but I requested him to just provide us with a summary. Why is it necessary? Because it is raised by a public member. So why is it necessary that it should be included? So he told me that the disputes for the owners is accommodated in the ombuds service. But for the rentals, they are using e-tribunals, housing tribunals. So I said, no, we must bring something so that when we look at this, the committee must take a decision. Otherwise, we have received a public comment on this one. So I would suggest that let's flag it for now, and then we'll wait for that. Maybe it is already there in the office. So I think Greg, somebody must phone Greg, or to check if Mr. Mazila has sent something. So, Mr. Singh?
Okay, look, I do agree with you. If we can improve on it, then we should. But if I read the original act, it says it includes any house, hostel room, hut shack. So whether it's within a corporate and a corporation environment or not, but it says includes any. And it goes so far as to say flat, apartment, room, outbuilding, which is leased. So, but obviously, if we can improve on it and make it very specific, then it would help, because it's implied. But, yeah.
We'll wait for that. Let's continue. There is on page, I don't know, I might have page. On page 4, chapter 2, promotion of rental housing properties. promotion of rental housing property. Okay.
Just on the process, are we not going to go through the ones we agree with, the ones that, we're now going to put in? Like, for example, the local municipality, minister, those definitions that are being changed.
Okay. All right.
Just so that we finish with the definitions.
Okay, okay. We've got the dwelling, we've got the financial institution, we've got the head of department, house rules, landlord, lease, and then MEC, where's local municipality? Oh, okay. Okay, Mr. Steen.
Just before that, should we not, under head of department, we are changing the word housing to human settlements. So should we not change that where we say, means the officer in charge of a department of the provincial government responsible for human settlements in the province?
Or head of department. Yes. Department of Human Settlements. Responsible for human settlements, yes. Okay.
And chair for the plan of minister. We are not saying minister of human settlements because it says the minister of housing.
Oh. Prescribed regulation, rental housing property includes one or more dwellings, rental housing information office, tenant, tribunal means, unfair practice. Yeah. With the definitions, is there any other?
Should we not correct rental housing information office? Means an office established by a local municipality rather than a local authority, because we're now putting in the definition of local municipality.
Section 11 of the 2011 bill, it says the principal act is hereby amended by the substitution for the expression local authority wherever it occurs of the expression local municipality. So that is 2011 amendment.
That even for housing, where housing should be replaced by human settlements, we should follow the similar format, that wherever it occurs, we should then be amended accordingly, so that we don't have to be picking them up one by one.
Maybe what we can do on that is I will make a note and then just go through the Principal Act and see where that does occur. So that if it is two spots, then it's easy to amend. But if it is more, you know, if it gets a lot of them, and then we will also see in which manner it is used. And we can say wherever the phrase this is it replaced by that. So I will make a note to look into that.
Then I've got the under promotion of rental housing property, responsibility of government to promote housing. Can you read the earlier before us?
Chapter 2.
Yes.
Promotion of rental housing property. Responsibility of government to promote rental housing. Government must A, promote a stable and growing market that progressively meets the latent demand for affordable rental housing among persons historically disadvantaged by unfair discrimination in poor persons, by the introduction of incentives, mechanisms and other measures that, number one, improve conditions in rental housing market, two, encourage investment in urban and rural areas that are in need of revitalization and resuscitation, and number three, correct distorted patterns of residential settlement by initiating, promoting and facilitating new development in or the redevelopment of affected areas. B, facilitate the provision of rental housing in partnership with the private sector. And two, measures introduced in terms of subsequent subsection one must A, optimize the use of existing urban and rural municipal and transport infrastructure, B, redress and inhibit urban fragmentation or sprawl, C, promote higher residential densities in existing urban areas as well as in areas of new or consolidated urban growth, and D, mobilize and enhance existing public and private capacity and expertise in the administration or management of rental housing. Number three, national government must introduce a policy framework, including norms and standards on rental housing to give effect to subsection one. Number four, provincial and local governments must pursue the object of subsection one within the national policy framework on rent. Provincial and local government must pursue the object of subsection one within the national policy framework on rental housing referred to in subsection three and within the context of broader national housing policy in a balanced and equitable manner and must accord rental housing particular attention in the execution of functions, the exercise of powers and the performance of duties and responsibilities in relation to housing development. Measures to increase provision of rental housing property.
I think we have picked up here that there's a suggestion from NHFC to add a 2E to provide legal mechanisms to protect the rights of tenants and landlords against illegal actions by the other party by affording speedy means of redress. I would think that also seems to fit in our preamble, also where they talk about the need to balance the rights of tenants and landlords and the legal to protect them. So that is here for us to discuss whether we would like to include that as another point under two.
I was thinking, what is the rental policy, Mrs. C? What does the rental policy say? Do it. I think last night you said we need to look at these two. Let's make it our homework. If this, what is the current policy? If this act now is also aligned to that policy, because as far as I can't remember, but we can request that from the department, a copy of the rental policy. Because you remember yesterday I raised something about the social housing. It is not consistent. The standards and norms, they are not consistent in applying those standards and norms. When you get to one flat, you will find that the flat has got a built-in cupboard. And then when you get to another one, you find that there are no built-in cupboards, but the price is the same. So the norms and standards, I'm sure that they do
have to be looked at. So, Charmaine is another homework.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, I think it's very important because this affects the actual responsibility of government. Mm-hmm. It is very important that we don't go outside of the policy. I think that is important. So I have made a note. We need to check the policy and make sure whether this actually fits in with the policy before we include it.
Okay. Mr. Stein?
Okay, just a small matter, and I don't know if the Apple's got a different version, but I think it was just a spelling.
Yeah, it's rent.
So
instead of rent.
Are we not going to fix it while we're busy with the amendment?
Let's fix it. Okay.
I've made a note that I want to speak to our Bill's office in Parliament, Mr. Neil Bell, to get the bill as was adopted in the Assembly in 1999, just to make sure that, because the type of errors that I find here seems to be a document that was scanned in and then made into a PDF. And then sometimes it picks up, it doesn't scan the words correct. So it might be that the bill was adopted correct, but that the version that we have is not. Because, for instance, it talks about RT persons instead of any person, which can't see the Assembly having made that mistake.
measures to increase provision of rental housing property. The minister may introduce a rental subsidy housing program. Is it a rental housing subsidy program, or do I have to just leave it like that, Chairperson? Just like that. Oh, the minister may introduce a rental subsidy housing program as a national housing program, as contemplated in Section 3.4G of Housing Act of 1997, Act Number 107 of 1997, or other assistance measures to stimulate the supply of rental housing property for low-income persons. Parliament may annually appropriate to the South African Housing Fund an amount to finance such a program. A separate account of income and expenditure in respect of such program must be kept. Number four, Section 12.1B of Housing Act 1997, Act Number 107 of 1997, does not apply to any amount appropriated by Parliament for purposes of such program. Chapter 3, Relations Between Tenants and Landlords.
Answer. Here there's relations, Chapter 3. When you get to the new, there's the rights and obligations. So we have to look at this one. And yes, I've noted it, the consistency.
Relations between tenants and landlords, general provisions. In advertising a dwelling for purposes of leasing it, or in negotiating a lease with a prospective tenant, or during.
On the 2007 one? That particular section was amended, so that's the one that Leopold should be reading, that we should look at. Page 2.
Amendment of Section 4 of Act 50 of 1999. Section 4 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. A, by the substitution of subsection 1 of the following subsection. In advertising a dwelling for a purpose of leasing it, or in negotiating a lease with a prospective tenant, or during the term of a lease, a landlord may not unfairly discriminate against such prospective tenant or tenants, or the members of such tenant's household, or the bona fide visitors of such tenants on one or more grounds, including race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, sexual orientation, ethnic or social origin, color, age, disability, religion, conscience, belief, culture, language, and birth. B, by the substitution of subsection 3 for paragraph C of the following paragraph, his or her possessions seized, except in terms of a law of general application and having first obtained a ruling by a tribunal or an order of court,
Chairperson, I think here the heading must be rights and duties of tenants and landlords.
Ndivumelana nawe into nayo ndisabhidekile. Ndisafunda ukutheka ukuthi i-difference yintoni kule nto ebendiyifunda ku-Principal Act. What has been amended? No, it is there. By ruling by the tribunal or an order of court, it is there in 5B. So I want to know what has been amended here. Mr. Stein, can you assist us?
Yes. If we need to actually look at the two together, because one sometimes replaces a clause in the other. So if we look at Section 4.1, it's been replaced. And in fact, all that they did there really was take out the words bona fide. But then 4.2 still applies. 4.3 applies except for C that has been changed. And if you look at 3C, Chairperson, it only makes mention of an order of the court. The 2007 amendment put in, added a ruling by a tribunal or a court. So, and then we need to continue with the original, again for 4, and hold on, there's a C, there's a 3C of the following paragraph. And then they substitute Section 4, the right set out in subsection 3. I know it all sounds confusing, but if you look at the 2007, there's a substitution again of 4. And it talks about the rights set out in subsection 3 apply equally to members of the tenant's households and visitors. So that was 4.4, which was substituted in 2007. We'll continue with clause 5 in the original act.
Okay.
Although, hold on, section 5, oh, that's, no, yeah, clause 5.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. No, 4 is not substituted. It's taken out the bona fide again. So, yes, but otherwise it remains the same.
Yeah. I also wanted to say the same thing, Chairperson, when you said you don't see any amendment. It's very difficult actually to see. But I think the actual amendment is that bona fide has been removed.
But, the problem, I need correction. So there are no, because this heading, relations between tenants and landlords. So there's a mix of issues here. Why can't you separate? Because those are the relations. Why can't you say rights and then there's this general provision and then you clearly put the rights? Because the rights and obligations, you can't just, they must be clear. People are reading this act, you will struggle to get, because when you read an act at home, I mean those on the people on the ground, you just rush to this issue that you think it relates to you. So when you want your rights here, you can't find your rights, because in fact you are going to be bored, because this thick document is going to bore you to say, where is my rights? Where are my rights? Where are my rights? And then you end up throwing this legislation. So I don't know, Charmaine, what can you do something for us?
Chairperson, definitely we can amend the heading, and then perhaps because there's a big section at 5 that goes on about leases, but perhaps we can include a section 5 capital letter A and a 5 capital letter B that specifically spells out, even if it repeats some of the things that are said in sections 4 and 5. But specifically say rights of landlords, and we list rights of tenants, and we list.
I wasn't quite sure if I was understanding you well about the rights.
I was saying the way they are put in here in this document, it's difficult to find them easily. So I'm saying this document is not user-friendly. Because when you've got a problem, as just an ordinary person, when you are you have got a challenge, you are picking up the legislation, and then you look at your rights, you are interested to see what are your rights in this matter. And then you peruse, you won't find any section that relates to your rights, because there the heading is saying relations between tenants. And then when you read, they start with general provisions. So you will get bored as an ordinary person, because you will think, check. And then you are saying illegal unity must assist to ensure that those rights are clearly provided for just an ordinary person to at least acquire goods born among church. So this act must be user friendly. That's what we are saying. So she's saying she's going to she's going to make a provision for that in this section. Mrs. Singh?
You see, for me, that first paragraph, where am I now? Well, on section 4. In advertising. Yeah, I was going to say, Chairperson, for me, at least an idea of my rights, for instance, when the landlord is advertising a house, for me, I see them here, because it says the landlord may not discriminate against me on the following grounds, and those grounds are taken from the Constitution. So for me, they are complete. When that landlord or landlady is advertising, she or he must not discriminate against me because of my sex, because of my sexual orientation, because of my religion, because of whatever. They are all here. those rights. Those are my rights.
We agree.
Only have the time. They can't say, for instance, this house is only meant for such and such a race of people.
Yes, ma'am. We have agreed on that one. I don't think there is a problem on that one. We are saying to the chapter here in the Principal Act, chapter 3, we are referring to chapter 3 of the Principal Act, where the rights and obligations now, when you have got that contract now, when you have already entered into a contract, that's the rights that we are referring to. Otherwise, the one in that section of advertising, the general provisions, we are happy about it. We don't have a problem. But what we are saying, they must be separated. Those are the rights and obligations when we are in a contract already. I think those are referred to here. So that's why we are saying at least they must be cleared up. Here are my rights. When I've got this contact with this, and then the landlord too. Mr. Singh?
Chair, since we are rewriting the Act, I want to give, to your proposal, that what we could possibly do, the proposal is we've got Chapter 3, Relations, and we've got General Provisions, which is Clause 4, and that we actually just make it Clause 4, not 4 bracket 1. 4 bracket 2 becomes another heading, and it could be either rights and obligations of tenant or rights of tenant. But that becomes in clause 5. And similarly, where 5 now speaks to the landlord's rights, that we have another heading, and obviously the subsequent changes in terms of that could possibly be clause 6 there. But we've now got them isolated under a heading, and we carry on.
I think Samini has taken that
The rights set out in subsection 3 apply equally to members of the tenant's household and to bona fide visitors of the tenant. The landlord's rights against the tenant include his or her right to a prompt and regular payment of the rental or any charges that may be payable in terms of a lease, b recover unpaid rental or any other amount that is due and payable after obtaining a ruling by the tribunal or an order of a court of law. Terminate the lease in respect of rental housing property on grounds that do not constitute an unfair practice and are specified in the lease. D. On termination of the lease, on the lease to, number one, receive the rental housing property in a good state of repair, save for fair wear and tear. And two, repossess rental housing property having first obtained an order of court. And E, claim compensation for damage to a rental housing property or any other improvement on the land on which the dwelling is situated, if any, caused by the tenant, a member of the tenant's household, or a visitor of the tenant. Provisions pertaining to leases.
Chairperson, that on termination of a lease, D, number 1, Roman letter 1, receive the rental housing property in a good state of repair, save for fair wear and tear. Now, I think we've raised this before. You know, what is fair wear and tear as opposed to, now let's say, for example, now I rent a flat. In 5 years' time after I've rented that flat, that carpet in there has started to wear. Now, is that fair wear and tear, or am I responsible for replacing that carpet? What is unfair wear and tear. And I think we need to be careful on that, because I think it can be open to abuse.
D2. We in this way we have said we are rejecting this. What are we really rejecting? What are we rejecting? Ruling, is it a ruling by the tribunal or a ruling by the court?
Chairperson, the proposed amendment is that the tribunal can also rule that rental housing must be repossessed. Now, that is rejected by the committee in the amendment that was discussed yesterday, and the reason for that is that currently, as the Act stands, the tribunal does not have the jurisdiction to make an eviction order.
State that, and here in the amendment. So let's. I was suggesting that we totally we are agreeing that we are deleting, we are rejecting it, and then based on what on that fact. So we need to be clear even in our report why we it has to be clarified. Comment?
Yes, Chair, I do need to have clarity, because it would seem to me that we're back to the original. We're taking out the tribunal bit, and we've rejected that, and we're back to the point number Romans 2 as it stands. That is my understanding. Otherwise, are we taking it out altogether? I would imagine we need something there. Perhaps even we need to look at
the court will remain the court should remain.
Yeah.
And then the tribunal be deleted.
And we need to look at that and to see whether that we can change the rest to fit in with allowing that. Now that we're doing a whole lot.
Chair, whilst I don't agree with the word repossess, however, we have to make an allowance for a tribunal, when a lease is terminated, the landlord must surely have the right to them, or the tenant must vacate the property. And the landlord must have that right, because there's no lease anymore. And if people then refuse, and it has happened and is happening, where people then simply refuse to vacate, the rights of the landlord is being infringed upon. And you will know that this, because of the PI Act, there are people that are abusing that and refusing to pay for years on end, but they're also not being evicted because the landlord then cannot afford to go to the court to get a court order. Now, I would imagine this was not so much meant to be repossession. I think that's the wrong word. It should really be, if there is no a lease anymore, then the landlord should have the right to have the property vacated. And it should then be left up to... Well, why not the rental tribunal or the court? I'm talking about under very simple conditions, not because somebody is being spiteful or willful, then they have to go to court. But there are certain conditions where if a tenant hasn't paid for a year but refuses to leave the property...
Then the problem is the eviction act. So why not the
problem? Okay. Yes, when we are dealing with the act, we have to look at the other acts. So... It means, let's leave it for court. And then maybe the eviction part, it will come when we are dealing with the other act. Yes. But the court must remain, in my opinion. I don't know how do you feel. So you are going to...
Can we flag that when we look at the...
in the same act there's something about eviction. Let's just look at the two.
Okay. And then we are also agreeing that that repossess is not the right. Okay, I'm going to give you the comfort break after we have finished this. We can finish it. Okay. Okay. Let's proceed to the provision pertaining to leases. Can you read this again? Because I've flagged it. Can you read this?
Provision pertaining to leases. A lease between a tenant and the landlord, subject to subsection 2, need not be in writing or be subject to the provisions or formalities in respect of leases of land Act 1969, Act number 18 of 1969. A landlord must, if requested thereto by a tenant, reduce the lease to writing. Number 3, a lease will be deemed to include terms enforceable in a competent court to the effect that the landlord must furnish the tenant with a written receipt for all payments received by the landlord from the tenant. B.
I get to one of the shops during my holiday. Whilst I was there, there came two policemen with another lady. They requested one of the members of the shop here to speak to them, only to find they were fighting. The issue was the rent. This lady has been appointed by the owner of the house. The owner of the house is in Pretoria. So she is the caretaker of this house in Kokstad. Now they are renting their house for 5,000 rand. The whole house. There's no agreement, but they are paying rent. Now, they are fighting for, this lady is saying they must pay in cash. They say, no, we're not going to pay you in cash. Give us the bank statement. I mean, the bank account, we're going to pay in the bank, and then we'll give you the receipt. Number one. Number two, this lady is saying, no, you are paying this 5,000. Now, you are mainly in this house. Each one of you should pay 1,000 rand. So, this thing is not written anyway. Now, she's coming now to say, pay 1,000. You are so many here. Each one of you should pay 1,000. So, I'm saying, where were the rules? Do we have an agreement? No agreement. Do we have the rules? Because if you are saying, for the sake of infrastructure, I would think I've been a burden. So we need to say at least there should be a minimum of so many people that are residing here. So if you're saying this, we insist that it must not be in writing. But what we need to say, it must not be in a complicated manner. It must be just simply, even if it's a one page. If it's a one page, for me, it is important that at least we must encourage that, even the act should encourage that, because now people are being taken in advantage. And then you say, I'm throwing you out of this house if you are not paying that much. So that matter was taken by the police. I don't know where they discussed it, and then I don't know about the outcome, because I just left. So I'm saying these things are happening.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think if it can be in black and white, that will assist, because the landlord will have a proof and the tenant will have a proof. And payments mustn't be in cash. Must be deposited into the bank account so that everyone can have a proof for that. And this will minimize also this issue, because in many cases, landlords become so greedy. Sometimes, when they will tell you that if you rent this house, it will be for 5,000 rand a month. But when they see maybe you are doing business, or let's say it's a saloon in that house, then they see, oh, this one is making a lot of money, then they'll change their story. So if there is something written in black and white,
then it will bind everyone. Bind the tenant to pay and the landlord to stick to his rules. Thanks, sir.
But it must be in a simplest form. I think we need to craft it in a way that is not going to... People must not think of these big contracts. That's simple, even in your language. Simple language or cause to say at least... Not even a... Even a two-pager. Yeah. Another performance.
Yes, I want to concur with what the Honourable Takuri has said here. That Section 2, a landlord must, if requested thereto by a tenant. So, you know, and the thing is, what have you got if you haven't got anything in writing and you go to a court? You've got nothing. It's just hearsay with what one person says or another person says. So I want to concur with that. I think we need to do something about Section 2 here.
And when you are desperate, you want an accommodation, you don't even think of that. This act is not meant for ordinary people. It's meant for elites. So I think we need to ensure that our ordinary people have in access. But let's encourage, I think Usamein will be able to make it easier so that people must not think of big contracts. Yes, those. Mr. Steen?
Sure, yes, quite a lot has been said, but what has been said really changes 5.1 and 5.2 into one clause, because 5.1 says that it need not be in writing, 5.2 says that if requested. So I think what we're saying is that we must simply say that a lease must be in writing.
Yes.
And we can add something more in terms of making it simpler in terms of common law. It mustn't. But having said that, Chair, we again forgetting, I think, I don't know if we've off that one, but there's an amendment to, on this section 5.3b. Before we go to that, Chair, just 5.1.3 as it is at the moment, should we not include once again, it says a lease will be deemed to include terms enforceable in a competent court to the effect. Should we not include once again enforceable in a competent court or by order of a rental tribunal?
Where is that?
5.3. It says a lease will be deemed to include terms enforceable in a competent court to the effect. I'm saying, should we not again put in the competent court or by an order of a rental tribunal? And then when we go on to A is fine. It talks about the receipt, but then in B, there's an amendment in 2007 which gives some form of exemption to landlords on application. So we just need to look at that one. In 2007, there's an amendment to 3B.
Amendment of Section 5 of Act 50 of 1999. Section 5 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. A. By the substitution in subsection 3 for paragraph B of the following paragraph. Such receipt must be dated and clearly indicate the address, including the street number and further description, if necessary, of a dwelling in respect of which payment is made and whether payment has been made for rental, arrears, deposit, or otherwise, and specify the period for which payment is made, provided that a tribunal may, in exceptional cases and on application by a landlord, exempt the landlord from providing the information contemplated in this paragraph. B, by the substitution of subsection 3D for the words preceding the provision of the following words. The deposit contemplated in paragraph C must be invested by the landlord in an interest-bearing account with a financial institution, and the landlord must subject to paragraph G, pay the tenant such interest at the rate applicable to such account, which may not be less than a rate applicable to a savings account, with A, that financial institution and the tenant may, during the period of the lease, request the landlord to provide him or her with written proof in respect of interest accrued on such deposit, and the landlord must provide such proof on request. And C, by the deletion of subsection 3 of the word, and at the end of paragraph A, the addition of the word, and at the end of paragraph B, and the addition to the subsection of the following paragraph. P, any cost in relation to contract of lease shall only be payable by the tenant upon proof of factual expenditure by the landlord.
I'm just thinking of this. No, it's fine. But what I'm thinking, if my lease has been terminated, and then we look at the damages in the house, so if the damages cost more than the deposit, what should I do? Am I supposed to pay the whole expenditure of the landlord, and then if it is over, or it is more, what should I do?
Davidson, if the damages were caused by the tenant, the tenant is liable for those damages.
Okay.
So, in the full amount of those damages. So, the deposit can be used towards those damages. If there is an amount remaining, then that must be paid back to the tenant. But if it is not sufficient, the tenant must make payment for the damages.
Okay. Now, I wanted to know.
It is covered under 5E, where it says the landlord's rights against the tenant include his or her right to recover unpaid rental or any other amount that is due and payable after obtaining a ruling by the tribunal or an order of the court of law. So again, the landlord can't just say you owe me 10,000 rand because this and this is broken. If you as a tenant feel that it's only 6,000 rand's worth, you can go to the tribunal and they can then determine it, and then you're liable. Yeah. So that's covered. Ask that we just, I don't want to flag it, but in the 2007, I mean, you raised the issue about receipts and things like that. Now, in the 2007 amendment, provision was specifically made to exempt some landlords on application, that they actually don't have to issue a receipt. And that's where I'm saying we should perhaps get, either the department needs to get in touch with the tribunals and find out, has there been such applications, and under what circumstances have they granted permission not to issue a receipt? And then, depending upon the information we get, we may want to relook at this.
I say, we are finalizing this chapter. I think my questions have already responded to the issue of costs.
Can you read the, where are you on a Liepo now?
D, the deposit contemplates, E, the tenant and the landlord must jointly, before the tenant moves into the dwelling, inspect the dwelling to ascertain the existence or not of any defect or damage therein, with a view to determine the landlord's responsibility for rectifying any defect or damage, or with a view to registering such defects or damage, as provided for in subsection 7. F. At the expiration of the lease, the landlord and tenant must arrange a joint inspection of dwelling at a mutually convenient time to take place within a period of three days prior to such expiration, with a view to ascertaining if there was any damage caused to the dwelling during the tenant's occupation thereof. G. On the expiration of the lease, the landlord may apply such deposit or interest towards the payment of all amounts for which the tenant is liable under the said lease, including the reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling during the lease period and the cost of replacing lost keys, and the balance of the deposit and interest, if any, must then be refunded to the tenant by the landlord not later than 14 days of restoration of the dwelling to the landlord. H. The relevant receipts which indicate the cost which the landlord incurred, as contemplated in paragraph G, must be available to the tenant for inspection as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. I. Should no amount be due and owed to the landlord in terms of the lease, the deposit, together with the accrued interest in respect thereof, must be refunded by the landlord to the tenant, without any deduction or set off within 7 days of expiration of the lease. J. Failure by the landlord to inspect the dwelling in the presence of the tenant, as contemplated in paragraph E or F, is deemed to be an acknowledgement by the landlord that the dwelling is in good and proper state of repair, and the landlord will have no further claim against the tenant, who must then be refunded, in terms of this subsection, the full deposit plus interest by the landlord. K. Should the tenant fail to respond to the landlord's request for an inspection as contemplated in paragraph F, the landlord must, on expiration of the lease, inspect the dwelling within 7 days from such expiration in order to assess any damage or loss which occurred during the tenancy. The landlord may, in the circumstances contemplated in paragraph K, without detracting from any other right or remedy of the landlord, deduct from the tenant's deposit and interest the reasonable cost of repairing damage to the dwelling and the cost of replacing lost keys. M. The balance of the deposit and interest, if any, after deduction of the amounts contemplated in paragraph L, must be refunded to the tenant by the landlord not later than 21 days after expiration of the lease. And the relevant receipts which indicate the cost which the landlord incurred, as contemplated in paragraph 1, must be available to the tenant for inspection as proof of such costs incurred by the landlord. And O, should the tenant vacate the dwelling before expiration of the lease without notice to the landlord, the lease is deemed to have expired on the date that the landlord established that the tenant had vacated the dwelling, but in such event, the landlord retains all his or her rights arising from the tenant's breach of the lease. Number 4, the standard provisions referred to in subsection 3 may not be waived by the tenant or the landlord. Number 5, if on the expiration of the lease, the tenant remains in the dwelling with the express or tacit consent Maritim lease to have entered into a period lease on the same terms and conditions as the expired lease, except that at least 1 month written notice must be given of the intention by either party to terminate the lease. 6. A lease contemplated in subsection 2 must include the following information. A. The names of the tenant and the landlord and their addresses in the Republic for purposes of formal communication. B. The description of the dwelling which is the subject of the lease. C. The amount of rental of the dwelling and reasonable escalation, if any, to be paid in terms of the lease. D. If rentals are not paid on a monthly basis, then the frequency of rental payments. E. The amount of the deposit, if any. F. The lease period, or if there is no lease period determined, the notice period requested for termination of the lease. G. Obligations of the tenant and the landlord, which must not detract from the provisions of subsection 3 or the regulations relating to unfair practice. H. The amount of rental and any other charges payable in addition to the rental in respect of the property. 7. A list of defects registered in terms of subsection 3E must be attached as an annexure to the lease as contemplated in subsection 2. 8. A copy of any house rules applicable to a dwelling must be attached as an annexure to the lease. 9. A landlord must ensure that the provisions of subsection 6, 7, and 8 are complied with.
I don't understand number 60. 60, Chairperson. If it can be clarified to me. I don't understand it.
A lease contemplated in subsection 2 must include the following. If rentals are not paid on monthly basis, then the frequency of rental payment.
Chairperson, all that happens here is most rental agreements are done on a monthly basis. A calendar month, this is the amount per calendar month. But there are some leases where it might be on an annual basis or a quarterly basis or even a weekly basis, or if we come maybe in more murky water, hourly basis. That could be your kind of rental period that they then talk. So in other words, your rental agreement will say 5,000 Rand, and then it will be assumed that that is per calendar month. But if you're talking daily, or in fact, a lot of the rentals on the coastline of Cape Town, they will advertise 5,000 Rand, and when you actually go into the advert, you see, oh, this is not per month, this is per day. So that is just what the frequency is.
We can break for, take a comfort break, just for 10 minutes. My time now is 5 to 12. It's 10 to 5 past 12, we can come back.
Continuing into the afternoon. I will need to be excused. I've got a study group in my other portfolio at 1 o'clock. Then I'll come back.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to go to the hospital. I'll be doing it. Thank you.
Can you start so that we take a lunch break at 1 and then we come back at 2 so that members can just do their businesses between 1 and 2. And then we come back. I would suggest that let's continue and finish this business today so that tomorrow we're not coming. As I've already alluded yesterday, that tomorrow we won't have any meeting. Friday, no meeting. So let's finalize this today so that our staff should be able to consolidate everything and send the information to the department as well as the state law advisors. I thank you.
Chair, since we're having a really good look at this act, I'm just wondering if when Charmaine is looking at under the provisions pertaining to leases, if again we could look at perhaps making it just a little bit more user-friendly and giving it headings, perhaps that would make it a lot easier to read instead of just the whole thing about deposits and what's in the lease and all of that. But if that perhaps could be divided up into things relating to the lease and things relating to the deposit that gets, and everything relating to the deposit, you know, if there's a way at least for us to look at it so that when people open up, they can, because this, I think this is very frightening for anybody to open up a thing like this and try and find a thing about the, where their deposits are and how, you know, how they claim that back and the checking of the flat and all of that thing.
Chapter 4.
Yes, this chapter 4.
Chapter 4, Rental Housing Tribunal, application of chapter, unless the province has before or after the commencement of this act enacted legislation providing for matters dealt with in this chapter. This chapter will apply to such province. Establishment of rental.
Chairperson, I just have a question here. First of all, there's an amendment. Yes, this chapter applies to all the provinces in the Republic of South Africa, and in the amendment, that is number 6. I'm just wondering what happens to this number 6 that's already here. Well, I don't think it does replace the 6.
This chapter applies to all provinces in the Republic of South Africa.
Existing 6 speaks about the commencement of this act, enacted legislation and so on.
What happens to that?
I don't quite grasp the question. This substitutes what is in the original goal. So 6, for the purpose of this, before we look at renumbering because of what we've added, that unless comes out and it's being substituted with this chapter applies to all provinces. It replaces the one where it says unless the province has, a chapter will apply to them. It now it applies to all provinces. What they're doing now is making it mandatory. So that thing just comes out.
Chairperson, yes, that is correct. It says there, the following section is hereby substituted for section 6 of the principal act. So 6 comes out and this replaces that. That is correct. Yeah.
So which means we new amendments, the establishment of rental housing tribunal. Here it's being amended as the composition. Ne? Where is the composition?
No, 7 is before the MEC, the separate MEC.
The MEC must instead of may.
Yes, every MEC must within 12 months.
Oh, it is, okay.
So there we look at the amendment proposed by.
Okay.
Functions of tribunal. The tribunal must fulfill the duties imposed upon it in terms of this chapter and must do all things necessary to ensure that the objectives of this chapter are achieved. Composition of tribunal. The tribunal must consist of not less than 3 and no more than 5 members who are fit and proper persons appointed by the MEC and must comprise.
So my argument there is say my point here is that it's the composition of tribunal. So we are changing to establishment of the RFT. So we are agreeing that the principal act is amended.
the heading. Are we in agreement, Mr. Sting?
No, we're not.
We are. I'm in chapter 4, 9. It's already changed by the department, not by us. Because the department, although they are not indicating, they are saying establishment of rental housing tribunals, and then they come down. When we get to this, it's a continuation. Is it not a continuation?
Different heading, Chair.
Mm-hmm.
The establishment is under 7, which they've replaced,
mm-hmm.
where it says now every MEC must.
Mm-hmm.
Then they keep 8 as it is, the functions, and we're now on the composition, which is 9. So that composition is...
Where composition?
9, right at the top of the existing Act, 92.
So it remains, it is.
It remains composition of the, now talks about the composition of the
okay.
tribunal.
Okay, all right. Okay, continue.
The tribunal consists...
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we couldn't just look at this because Charmaine has referred to the membership of the tribunal. Do we want to perhaps, now that we're looking at it, is composition a word that people easily, you know, relate to, or is membership a better word to use?
Yeah, I think for me, I don't want to respond to what Honorable Pomen is saying, but I think we need to, even in this one, it must be clear, because if it is a, you are saying composition or membership, we need to agree on one. Because here, Mrs. Stein, we have already changed, made some changes in the composition. But I think the heading is very crucial. So there is no heading. There is a heading here, but I think we need to talk around that. Charmaine, can you help us? You are welcome, Mr. Dennison. Mr. Dennison is the committee content advisor, NCOP, in our committee there, that is in the NCOP. You are more than welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. The word composition is used very regularly to indicate what a body will consist of. I would say there is nothing wrong with the use of the word. Making it membership of the tribunal will also not be incorrect, because we are talking about members as it goes down. So it could be either. Usually the word composition is used.
Chair, I'm just trying to think of your people really on the ground. I'm not talking about people who, you know, like myself or us sitting around this table here, but people who perhaps are not regularly in contact with documents and things like this. If they pick something up and they read it, you know, is composition as explicit as is membership? And I think what we are doing is we're trying to say, you know, we want to help the people on the ground, and by and large, it's the poor people who very often miss out on the, you know, what is available to them. Myself, I think that membership is a far friendlier word. It indicates what it is. It's membership. No,
yeah, I've got no feelings one way or the other. All I want to sort of guard against is that, and I understand and fully support that our legislation should be so that people generally understand it. But there are convention and certain words that are associated with legislation. That we must be very careful that we're not trying to make it again too simplistic by veering. And the other lady from the law offices there should make and maybe guide us there as well. But I don't have very strong feelings one way or another.
The composition or the membership, whatever, but it must be clear, it must be clarified.
The tribunal consists of not less than three or no more than five members who are fit and proper persons appointed by the MEC and must comprise.
No, let's read it.
The amended one. Members of the tribunal, clause 5, section 9. Section 9 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. A. By the substitution of subsection 1 of the following subsection. 1. The tribunal consists of The tribunal consists of 7 members who are fit and proper persons appointed by the MEC and must comprise A. Chairperson who is suitably qualified and has the necessary expertise and exposure to rental housing matters. 6 members of whom 2 shall be persons with expertise in property management or housing development matters. 2 shall be persons with expertise in consumer matters pertaining to rental housing or housing development matters. And 2 shall be persons with legal qualifications. Which one? And then we jump to
C is amended.
Jumping to 2007. Section 9 of Principal Act is hereby amended by the deletion of subsection 1 of paragraph C by the insertion after subsection 1 of the following subsection. 1A. The MEC must appoint a deputy chairperson from the members referred to in subsection 1B and by the substitution in subsection 5 for paragraph A of the following paragraph. Any vacancy in the office of the member of the tribunal must, within 3 months of such vacancy occurring, be filled by the MEC appointing another member under subsection 1 or 3.
Okay. So, meeting. We are told it's the appointment.
The chairperson and members of the tribunal must be appointed only after A. The MEC has through the media and by notice in the Gazette invited nominations of persons as candidates for their respective positions on the tribunal. And B. The MEC has consulted with the relevant standing or portfolio committee of the provincial legislature, which is responsible for housing matters in the province. 3. The MEC may appoint 2 persons to serve as alternative members of the tribunal in the absence of any member referred to in paragraph B of subsection 1, but such persons must have the relevant expertise contemplated in paragraph B of subsection 1.
Mm.
Let's wait for him to finish. There's another three.
Does from Shamil's. Yeah. Suggestion that we make the alternate members more than only two. So it fits into that subsection 3 there, 9.3. So we need to say the MEC may appoint.
Okay.
9.3. The MEC may appoint. 6. Well, the MEC may appoint persons to serve as alternate members of the tribunal in the absence of any member referred to in paragraph B, 1, 2, and 3 of subsection 1, respectively. But such persons must have the relevant expertise contemplated in paragraph B.
We are deleting 2. We omit. Two persons. Yes. Is that what you are referring to, Mr. Singh?
Yes, Chair. I just want to raise something there. And I'm again thinking, and I know I raised it yesterday, and that's why we went for 6 in all provinces. But, you know, I suppose it is my argument that some smaller provinces may not sit simultaneously, I think, falls away because of geography, if nothing else. So it would make sense to have 6 alternates. I wanted to give some sort of leeway where they could choose a minimum of, I don't know, 2 or 3 and a maximum of 6, and not make it compulsory that they appoint 6 alternates. It's just up for debate.
Awesome.
Thank you, Chairperson. Subsection 3 is may appoint. So there we have a nice may, which means that if they only want to appoint 2 because it is a smaller province, then that will be in order. But they may appoint up to 6. Well, because we can add may appoint up to 6 persons to serve as alternate. We can add that.
In terms of subsection 1 or 3, must be for a period not exceeding 3 years, but a person whose term of office as a member has expired may be reappointed by the MEC for an additional period not exceeding 3 years. 5 has been amended in 2007. Yeah, I'm right. Any vacancy in the office, that is from 2007, any vacancy in the office of a member of the tribunal must, within 3 months of such vacancy occurring, be filled by the MEC appointing another member under subsection 1 or 3.
I have to take us back. If we look at the original amendments as they've come to us, if you look under 5B down at the bottom of that section, it says 4A, by the insertion of the subsection 4 of the following subsection. 4A, a person appointed in terms of subsection 4 may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms, and plus there's that extra bit of Charmaine's that goes in there on the not losing the continuity. So that amendment, we are now suggesting another amendment which needs to go in here after 4.
So another addition, the first set of amendments made by this committee also adds a subsection 1B
to section 9. So under I'm just going to make sure that I'm in the right place now. Right? Oh, there's the 1A. It's the MEC must appoint a deputy chairperson from the members referred to. And then 1B, the members of the tribunal must be broadly representative in terms of gender and people with disabilities. And then maybe if I can go ahead, because we have done number 2, we have done number 3, number 4A, which is being added, now reads, a person appointed in terms of subsection 4 may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms, provided that succession plans must ensure that, for the sake of continuity, all members are not replaced at once. And then we're at 5, which was also dealt with in the 2007.
Once we're there in the underrepresentative part, when we are so specific to say in terms of gender, why are we leaving the demographics? No. But in the Act, we know that it's a legislative requirement that the demographics are also included in any event. But now we are saying in terms of, so it means we are leaving out the other more special demographics. Because there are not the way in it is. I'm not comfortable the manner it has been crafted.
See, I'm being from an urban environment, I'm obviously not too plural. Normally we're very cognizant of that when it's a national bill and there's one board, for example, then we ask that the demographics be taken into consideration. But we're talking about provincial bodies here, so your national demographics are being considered because every province must establish, unless you're talking about demographics within a province. That board within that province must try and accommodate the boundaries within that province. Unless you're talking about that, then we need to somehow craft something. Not demographics. I'm talking about...
Yes. I think it is important that it must also be reflected that at least instead of saying in terms of gender, whether taking into cognizance in legislation is guided in South Africa in terms of in other demographics and so on and so on, not geographic.
I'm just a little bit lost. Where are you talking about now? I'm not too sure which one you're at.
Thank you.
This question is really for Charmaine. The way I read this, I've got no problem with it, but there's an interpretation that I get when I read this. I'm talking about the replacing all members at once. And I fully agree with the sentiments here, but it says a person appointed in terms of subsection 4 may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms. Now we've put in, provided that succession plans must ensure that for the sake of continuity, all members are not replaced at once. The word provided in this context, does that not mean if I as a MEC have not made succession plans, that means that 2 consecutive terms, I don't have to apply that? Because we it's almost like we're leaving an open door, provided that all succession plans that must ensure. So if the succession plan doesn't ensure, does it mean we don't have to stick to the 2 consecutive terms? The way it's written, yeah.
No, then your succession plan is a corporate governance principle that we're not enforcing. We can make it stronger so that there must be a succession plan in place so that we can change it that way. The provided is actually a cheating way in legislative drafting where you combine 2 sections into 1. So that's actually what I did with the provided. But we can make it stronger to say that provided that succession plans must be adopted and must provide that and must provide for replacement in such a manner that all members are not replaced at once. Because the idea is then that some members in the initial phase will serve perhaps less than 3 years, so that there will be a replacement will start earlier. So that's the idea. I'll try and make it stronger.
Just a question whilst we are trying to unpack this a little bit. Let us say, for example, a tribunal is formed, and it has its 7 members, and you come to the end of the maximum, the 2 terms. I don't know if this is possible, but you know, we need to allow for it. And nobody in the interim has been replaced. So everybody's of equal number of years. Who determines who goes and who stays? Because we want to keep the expertise. Everybody's had an equal term, and now you want somebody to remain behind. How do we deal with that?
Okay. Chairperson, that again is a corporate governance principle, and how that usually works in practice. But remember that corporate governance principles aren't enforceable, but I know coming from the department, how it was dealt with there is that there's actually the terms of reference of the body gets redrafted to say that in the next period, a third will be replaced in the first year, a third in the second year, a third in the third year. How to determine those thirds? There's a couple of ways of criteria. You can look at the position that they fulfill. In other words, the chairperson will go last because he will have been most involved, the deputy chairperson as well. You will look at attendance to see who was there most regularly. You will speak to the members themselves and say, we need to replace. Is there any of you that would like to? So it becomes a practical, a little bit of a conundrum, but in the end, it is the MEC that's appointing. And if there is no resolution in the end and they can't resolve it, then the MEC must simply put names in a hat, draw, and say,
these first three you go the first year, those three the next year, or, you know, something like that.
Well, at 5B, which reads as follows. Any member so appointed holds office for the unexpired portion of the predecessor's term of office. 6. The MEC may, at any time for reasons which are dark or fair, remove from office any member appointed under subsection 1 or 3, and appoint another person to the vacancy resulting therefrom in accordance with subsection 5. 7. A member or an alternate member of the tribunal, other than the person who is in the full-time employment of the state or an organ of state, must be appointed on the conditions of service determined by the MEC, with the approval of the member of the Executive Council responsible for provincial expenditure in the relevant province. 8. Conditions of service so determined may differ according to whether the person concerned is appointed on a full-time or part-time basis. 9. Members of the tribunal must be reimbursed by the head of department out of funds appropriated in terms of Section 2.1 in respect of reasonable expenditure incurred in the exercise of their duties under this Act. Meetings of tribunal. 10.1. The tribunal will sit on such days and during such hours and at such places as the chairperson of the tribunal may determine. And this has been amended. From this copy, yes, amendment of Section 10 of Act 50 of 1999. Section 10 of Principal Act is hereby amended by the insertion after subsection 2 of the following subsections. 2A, the chairperson presides at all meetings of the tribunal. 2B, where the chairperson is not present at the meeting, the deputy chairperson presides, or if the deputy chairperson is not present, the members of the tribunal present must appoint from amongst themselves a member to preside at such a meeting. From Charmaine's proposed amendment, clause 6, section 10, section 10 of the Principal Act is hereby amended, A, by the substitution for subsection 1 of the following subsection. 1. The tribunal must meet on such days and during such hours and such places as the chairperson of the tribunal may determine after consultation with other members of the tribunal, provided that the tribunal subject to section 10.2b and 10.5, arrange two simultaneous meetings in different geographical areas for purposes of effective functioning. In the Principal Act, a local authority may, at the request and at no cost to the tribunal, make a venue available for meetings of the tribunal. 4. Meetings of the tribunal must be convened for the consideration of A. Any complaint referred to the tribunal in terms of Section 13. B. Any other matter which the tribunal may or must consider in terms of this Act. From the copy of Charmaine, number 5, it reads as follows. The quorum of any meeting of the tribunal is 3 members, of which at least two must be members appointed in terms of 1. Section 9.1b, respectively, and Section 9.1b, B1 or 2. Six in the Principal Act, decisions of the tribunal subject to subsection 7 must be taken by consensus. 7, where consensus cannot be reached by the tribunal, the decision of the majority of the members of the tribunal must be the decision of the tribunal. 8, in the event of an equality of votes on any matter, the person presiding at the meeting of the tribunal will have a casting vote in addition to that person's deliberate vote. 9, a member or any alternate member of the tribunal must not attend or take part in the discussions of or decision-making on any matter before the tribunal in which he or she or his or her spouse or his or her relative within a certain degree of affinity or his or her partner or his or her employer other than the state or the partner of the employer of his or her spouse or of a spouse has any direct or indirect pecuniary interest. 10, minutes of the proceedings of the tribunal must be kept and retained at the offices of the tribunal. 11, no decision taken by the tribunal will be invalid merely by reason of a vacancy in the tribunal or of the fact that any person not entitled to sit as a member of the tribunal sat as such a member of the time when the decision was taken. If the decision was taken by the majority of the members of the tribunal present at the time and who were entitled to sit as members of the tribunal. 12, any person may, in the prescribed manner, obtain copies of minutes contemplated in subsection 10 against payment of a prescribed fee. Staff. 11, the staff required for the for the proper performance of the tribunal's functions and that
something here that says plus 12A. I've just got a is that in there's no 12A here. Oh no, it's in another place. It's in another place, sorry.
Chair, I was just checking on this meeting of tribunal. The whole scenario. What I want to get from that, there is no monitoring mechanism by the minister, the involvement of MEC to these meetings, because there is no such thing that the minister is going to monitor this occasion, any occasion.
I think the monitoring process is done through getting the reports and minutes of those, and then if there are any issues that the minister, I mean the MEC, would like to discuss with the tribunal. She can arrange. She can arrange a meeting. So I think let's not be prescriptive too much. I think it's fine because the minutes are there, the reports are there. They have to provide those reports. So that's where he's going to monitor the performance of the tribunal. You see?
I've just got a bit of a question mark that's hanging over something that was read here. I'm looking at what was it, 10.11, the 10 subsection 11. No decision taken by the tribunal will be invalid merely by reason of a vacancy in the tribunal, and this is where I've got the question. Or if the fact that any person not entitled to sit as a member of the tribunal sit as such a member at the time. Now, elsewhere in the document, it's very clear who are members of the tribunal. Now, I'm wondering how you're going to get somebody to sit who is not entitled to sit, if elsewhere in the document it says who must sit.
Chairperson, this section is something that is inserted for just in case. What it refers to is a person may be appointed as a member. It was seemingly a proper appointment, but afterwards it comes out that perhaps say subsection 9 comes into play, and you realize that, you know what, this person's second removed father works at this employer, and he was actually not supposed to sit on that tribunal. Or it comes later that there was some problem with the appointment of the membership. Maybe it wasn't signed. The letter was sent off before the MEC signed it.
So anything like that, which is, you know, it was just a mistake. It was an omission. And if that is the case, then the decision will stand. It will still be valid as long as two of the three members agree to that decision.
Staff, the staff required for the proper performance of the tribunal's functions and the administration of this act must be appointed subject to the laws governing the public service. Two, the staff contemplated in this subsection, in subsection one, may include inspectors, technical advisors, mediators, and administrative support staff. Any person appointed in terms of subsection 1 must be provided with a certificate of appointment signed by or on behalf of the head of department. 4. The tribunal may, subject to such conditions as it may determine, delegate any powers conferred on it other than a power under section 13(2)(d). 3, 4, and 5 to a member of the tribunal or a person appointed in terms of subsection 1, but any such delegation will not preclude the tribunal from exercising any such delegated powers itself, and the tribunal may set aside or amend any decision of the delegate made in the exercise of such powers. Funding of and reporting on activities of tribunal. The activities of tribunal must be funded from monies appropriated by the provincial legislature. The head of department is the accounting officer in respect of monies appropriated in terms of subsection 1. 3. An annual report on the activities of the tribunal must be submitted by the chairperson of the tribunal to the MEC as soon as possible after, but within four months of 31 March in each year. 4. The MEC may require the tribunal to submit additional reports to him or her, as the MEC may require from time to time. 5. Any report referred to in subsection 3 must be tabled in the provincial legislature within 30 days after receipt thereof by the MEC if the provincial legislature is in ordinary session, or if the provincial legislature is then not in ordinary session, within 30 days of the commencement of the next ensuing ordinary session. Complaints.
On the point of staff number 2, the staff completed in subsection 1 may, is it right if we say may include inspectors or technical advisors, or must include?
I think we may, all right. May is fine. May. For me, may is okay. But I want to check from Charmaine. May is fine there. So I think the question that you raised at the beginning is covered on the funding and reporting of the activities. So it's covered. Honourable members, let's take a break for lunch, and then people can go to their offices, have a finger lunch, can run to your office and do something that you think you want to do. 2 o'clock, 5 to 2. No. 1 to 2, we are here. 2 o'clock, we start. At least. Thank you.
Oh, Joseph.